Aunt Val got pregnant. Some judge we never met decided Donald should be with Sean. The last night of the circus that was our lives, a lawyer came to pick up Donald, because Sean Quinn was a coward. He wasn't brave enough to face Wavy and watch her hug Donald goodbye. She shook all over, while Donald cried and tried to comfort her.
"I'll come for the summer. You can send me letters. I'll come home for the summer. Uncle Sean says so. That I can come for the summer."
When I started to worry the lawyer would have to pry them apart, Wavy took her hands off Donald and stepped back with a horrible, empty look on her face. While the rest of us went to the door to see Donald off, she crawled into the closet under the stairs. She stopped eating. Really stopped. She got thinner and paler, walking up and down in her nightgown. Mom threatened to take her to the doctor. One day I got to the cafeteria at school and opened my lunchbox to find half my sandwich gone. Sitting next to me, Angela looked at the half sandwich with one eyebrow up. "Going on a diet?" she said. "I think maybe Wavy's going to live," I said. Wavy did live. She kept eating, secretly, and she went to school. In her dismal white pin-tucked dresses, she looked like a consumptive child from the 19th century, transported to the raucous hallways of a public school. She caught up on the coursework she'd missed and survived her freshman year of high school. Survived being stared at and whispered about. Every week she wrote two letters, one to Donald and one to Kellen. Sometimes she got a short note or a postcard from Donald, but nothing from Kellen. Eventually Mom sat Wavy down at the kitchen table and handed her a stack of letters. Every letter she'd sent to Kellen, all returned from the prison marked "Unauthorized Correspondence." "The judge says you're not allowed to write to him, and he's not allowed to write to you. He'll get in trouble if he communicates with you." Mom sounded almost sorry. Wavy gathered up the letters and carried them to her room. She never said a word, and I never saw her write to Kellen again. She usually wrote to Donald after she finished her homework in the evenings, and she always signed the letters, "See you soon. Love, Wavy." "See you soon. See you soon." Donald didn't come for the summer that year, or any other. Wavy's sophomore year, her last letter to him came back stamped, "Not at this address. No forwarding order." 10. Donald. April 1984.
I wasted too much time at the sandwich counter waiting for Sean to come out of the bathroom.
The counter guy came by twice and said, "Where'd your dad get to?" "The bathroom." That's what I said both times.
"He's been gone a while, hasn't he?"
I shrugged, like Wavy. Because what was I supposed to do? Sean always took a long time in the bathroom. Sometimes I had to go get him, and he'd be asleep on the toilet with his needle in his arm. So the counter guy wouldn't ask me again. I got up and walked over to the gas station. That's when I saw the postcards. I ran out to the car and looked for money. We didn't have the Corvette anymore, and the new car smelled bad under the seats, like gas and rotten stuff. The carpet was sticky from where somebody spilled a pop. Not me. I found enough for the postcard, a pretty one of the Grand Canyon that Sean said we didn't have time to see, but I didn't have enough money for the card and a stamp. The lady at the cash register said, "That's okay. I can spot you 4 cents. She was nice. I was glad I didn't steal the card. Then I had to borrow a pen, because that was how life was with Sean. I liked it better when I lived with Sandy. I didn't always have to beg or steal things. I wrote as fast as I could, but I didn't want it to be messy. "Dear Wavy, we had to move, and I don't know where yet. I will write to you again when I know where. See you soon. Love, Donald."
"Who are you writing to, sweetie?" the cashier lady said.
"My sister."
"That's nice."
I wished she would be quiet, because it was hard to remember Aunt Brenda's address. Before I could write the zip code, Sean put his hand on my shoulder. "What you doing, Dawn?" He's such a cutie. He's writing his sister a postcard.
Come on, buddy. You can finish that in the car, he said.
In the parking lot, he took the postcard and put it in the trash. He squeezed my shoulder hard and said,
Dawn, didn't we talk about how it's not safe for you to write to your sister?
I didn't tell her where we were, I said.
I don't want you sneaking around behind my back like that again. Do you understand?
I nodded. Wavy was right. Sometimes you have to nod, even if you don't agree. She was right about a lot of things. 11. Wavy. 1986. After Kellen was unauthorized correspondence, and Donald was no forwarding order, I felt dead. I woke up in the morning surprised my heart was still beating. The food I snuck at night tasted like nothing. I stole a whole red velvet cake from Mrs. Nyblack that was for a charity auction. It tasted like dirt. That was what I imagined it was like being dead, feeling empty with the taste of dirt in your mouth. Whatever Val felt now that she was dead, I couldn't think of her as Mama anymore. I wanted to take her flowers like Kellen had done for his mother, but I couldn't stand to go see her now that she was lying next to Liam. Feeling dead was better than when my heart hurt. Sometimes I thought it might burn through my ribs while I was asleep and smolder in the sheets until the whole house caught fire. The only thing that made it hurt less was moving my hands. Like Kellen washing dishes, making his head empty. I sliced and knitted and ironed and sanded and hammered and typed, trying to make my heart empty. Home economics class, typing class, woodshop class, homeroom where I volunteered to make decorations for dances. The questions never stopped, but in high school I learned a new way to deal with them. No matter what the question was, I nodded. Were your parents really murdered? Yes. Did your boyfriend kill your parents? Yes. Is it true you were gang-raped by some bikers? Yes. Aunt Brenda told the story to her book club, and they told someone else, who told someone else, and on and on and on, getting less true every time it got told, even less true than Aunt Brenda's version. I mostly liked high school. I liked learning things, how numbers worked together to explain the stars, how molecules made the world, all the ugly and wonderful things people had done in the last 2,000 years. I also liked watching people. The girl who was pregnant changed the way she moved to hide it. The boy who looked at people like they were bugs scribbled angry things in his notebook. The teachers kissing desperately in the storage room weren't married to each other. Amy stood too close to the Spanish teacher when she worked the football concession stand. Leaning over, she brushed her arm longingly against Mrs. Ramirez's arm. Watching and doing made things bearable. Also, time passed, even while I slept. After I turned 21, Aunt Brenda wouldn't be able to frown and say, I don't think that's an appropriate way to spend your trust fund. Even before that, I would be 18. I could find out things Aunt Brenda didn't want me to know. Where was Donald? How long until Kellen was free? In the meantime, the things that hurt other people healed me. At the end of my freshman year, a girl in my class was raped, held down and raped by two boys in a bullpen at the city baseball diamond. The rape made other girls nervous, but it reminded me that Kellen loved me. He hadn't raped me. I slipped secret notes in the girl's locker, notes to say, you're very good at math, and your hair is pretty today. During my junior year, a boy in Amy's class killed himself. He had terrible acne, purple welts like bee stings all over his face, and he went home from school and hung himself. I could have told him there was no sense in rushing toward being dead. It would find you soon enough, and before it did, there were pleasures to make your heart hurt less. If I lay very still in bed at night, I remembered how Grandma's house smelled. the taste of mint ice cream on Kellen's tongue. Donald jumping on the bed to wake me up. For everyone else, the boy killing himself was scary. It made Aunt Brenda hug Amy harder and tell Leslie it was okay if she wanted to move home from the dorm, where she was lonely, even though the college was only 20 miles away. It made them go to church more, hoping God would comfort them. I didn't think God could comfort anyone, but I was content to go and sit in the sanctuary. People stared at me sometimes, but they had to follow the rules, and I didn't. God made everyone else stand up and sing, sit down and pray, stand up, sit down, pray, sing, pray. God didn't seem to care if I read novels or knitted scarves. Youth group was harder to get through. Charlotte, the youth pastor, was a hugger. She was big and blonde with an enormous mouth full of teeth to hold her big smiley voice. Once she visited the house, so she and Aunt Brenda could discuss her concerns about me not being baptized. Swimming in a stock tank under the full moon didn't count. "I know you'll be discreet," Aunt Brenda told Charlotte, "so I'm just going to tell you the whole sordid story, to help you understand, so you can be sensitive to Wavy's situation." Only Aunt Brenda didn't tell the whole sordid story. She never told anyone about the deposition, but especially not Charlotte. As much as Charlotte loved crying and hugging, she loved to talk about sex more. Or she loved to talk about how you weren't supposed to have sex. "God made your body a temple to honor him, and he wants you to cherish that gift. He doesn't want you to put drugs in it. He doesn't want you to hurt yourself driving recklessly. And he doesn't want you to share yourself with just anyone. The gift of your temple is for you to share with the special person God has chosen for you." Charlotte always looked so happy when she talked like that. Ecstatic. God also didn't want you to pollute yourself. Touching yourself for pleasure wasn't what God designed your temple for, according to Charlotte. Either God was stupid or Charlotte was confused, because my temple was clearly designed for that. "When you get married, the purity of your temple will be a gift you give not only to your spouse, but to God. The gift of honoring his commandments." Charlotte wasn't married, and sometimes I caught her looking at Kellen's ring on my finger. I wondered, was Charlotte saving her loud-mouthed temple for someone? The girl in front of me had a better question. "But what about people who aren't virgins when they get married?" "Our God is a merciful God," Charlotte said. "If a person honestly regrets what they've done, but what if it's not their fault?" "Yeah, like what if a girl gets raped?" Amy's best friend Angela said. She sounded mad.
Charlotte's mouth made a big O.
"That's not the same thing," said Marcus. He had a crush on Amy, but he might as well have been at home polluting his temple as sitting there mooning over her.
"Marcus is right. That's not the same thing."
Charlotte's voice went into its pre-cry quaver.
"God understands that bad things can happen to good people."
"But it still means you're not a virgin," said the girl in front of me.
"God can make everything right if we trust him. If we pray, he can take cancer away. He can bring people back to life."
"So God could make you a virgin again?" People laughed at the girl for asking that, but Charlotte said,
"Why is that so funny? God parted the Red Sea and Jesus resurrected Lazarus. He can do anything."
When everybody broke for snacks, I stayed in my corner reading. Sometimes Amy and Angela sat with me, but Leslie was there that night, wanting to run away from college and sneak back into her safe high school life. The three of them were at the refreshment table when Charlotte walked over to me.
"Can we talk, Wavy?"
Without waiting for an answer, Charlotte sat down and scooted her chair up as close as she could so no one else would hear, like I would want to have a secret with her.
"I want you to know that I believe what I said with all my heart. What happened to you? God can heal you of that, because he knows that in your heart, you're still pure."
Charlotte's hand swooped toward my arm, but stopped short of touching me.
Will you let me pray with you? Ask God to heal you? To take away what was done to you and make you whole?
I don't want your God to make me a virgin, I said.
12. Amy. 1986 to 1987.
Wavy said it loud enough that everyone in the youth group lounge heard her. Then she walked over to Leslie and held out her hand. Car keys? Wavy, she's just trying to help, Leslie said. Charlotte hurried up to us and gasped.
Will you ask Wavy to come into my office to talk, Leslie?
Wavy snapped her fingers angrily at Leslie. I could see in Wavy's eyes that she had maybe only 10 seconds of calm left. Angela saw it too and said, Geez, Les, give her the keys. They're in my purse.
Oh, Wavy, please let me help you.
Charlotte was getting ready to cry. Wavy turned on her heel, crossed to where Leslie's purse hung over the back of her chair. In one economical movement, she emptied Leslie's purse on the seat and picked up the keys. 5 steps to the door, and she was gone. She doesn't want your help, Angela said.
God wants to heal her. If only she would open her heart, Charlotte said.
She's fine. Only as I said it, did I realize it was true. Considering everything she'd been through, Wavy was doing pretty well. We better go, Leslie said. One of those rare occasions when Leslie and I agreed. She put her stuff back in her purse and we left. Behind us, Charlotte sniffled. When we got to the car, Wavy was curled up in the back seat. I got in beside her while Angela rode up front with Leslie. What a witch, Angela said. She's probably not even a virgin. Not that I can imagine anyone having sex with her. It's not true. Wavy's voice was flat. Charlotte's right. I know you don't like her, but she's right. What happened to you doesn't count, Leslie said. I didn't know if she wanted to reassure Wavy or reassert Charlotte's ecclesiastical authority on renewable virginity. I am a virgin. Leslie flicked on the windshield washer. She didn't have the nerve to ask, but I couldn't stand not knowing. But what about... I hesitated because it wasn't a name to be said lightly in our family. Kellen. He never fucked me. Wavy, watch your mouth! Leslie's perfect impersonation of Mom. I ignored her.
But the police report. Your deposition. His alibi.
Wavy hugged her knees more tightly, her white skirt bunching over her black stockinged legs. That was the first time I realized that while Leslie and I were growing up, Wavy was staying the same. Staying 14. Not even that. Staying 13. In 3 years, she hadn't grown at all.
But your blood on the desk blotter.
Why was I arguing? To say, no, you can't be a virgin? The police report said so. Kellen pled guilty.
He broke my hymen with his fingers, Wavy said.
See? Really? You're still a virgin. Angela leaned over the back seat, trying to help.
I wish he had fucked me.
You don't mean that, Leslie said, half sad, half disapproving.
No one could take that away.
I didn't blame Wavy for feeling that way. The bike and the ring, they were just things. Donald and Kellen were all she cared about, and they'd both been taken away from her. In bed that night, I said,
What was it like?
It makes me sound like a morbid ghoul, but why else had Wavy offered that secret? She wanted to tell someone.
Wonderful. His hands are big and rough. He slid his ring finger into me. It burned. There was blood, but I wanted to have him in me. He wouldn't.
But your deposition... I kept coming back to the gospel. Wavy spoke in Apocrypha.
He wouldn't. He was scared of hurting me and he wanted to wait until we got married. Rubbing against me made him come. On the desk. Between my legs, not in me. He never fucked me.
I didn't know what to say, so I lay there and listened to the whisper of covers moving over her flannel nightdress. Tiny sparks leapt like lightning in a petri dish meadow. Wavy sighed and shivered and hiccuped. After sharing a room with her for 3 years, I was used to the sound of her masturbating. I never got used to the sound of her crying. I lost my own virginity at a party 4 months later. It involved a nice guy named Marcus, who thought he was in love with me, and too much alcohol. I felt like such a coward about that. Instead of going into it with my eyes open, I lied to myself. I thought if I was drunk, it would be this magical thing that just happened. I'd had a huge fight with Angela, who was going to a different college on a track and field scholarship. She kept saying, "We'll visit each other." But then I found out she was getting back together with her ex-boyfriend, who was going to the same school. Her ex-boyfriend who hated me. I knew we would never visit each other if she was dating him. When I told her she deserved better, she got mad. "You don't own me," she said. I felt like my heart had been ripped out, and when Wavy and I got to the party, Marcus was there. I wanted it to be wonderful, like Wavy said, but it was awkward and painful and embarrassing. I was so drunk that after Wavy and I got home, I was sick. We managed to sneak past Mom and into the bathroom, where I vomited my guts up and cried. "I don't love him," I sobbed. I liked him, but I didn't love him. I wasn't even attracted to him beyond the fact that he had good hygiene. I thought it meant something that he was in love with me, but it only means something if you love the other person. And I loved Angela. "It's over," Wavy said as I lay on the floor with a cold washcloth on my forehead. I thought she meant the puking, but she said, "Nothing left to be afraid of." I'd been afraid of so many things. Sex, graduating, college, leaving home, falling in love, life. Now I'd fallen in love, gotten my heart broken, and had meaningless sex. Those scary things were over. In 3 months I would leave for college. There would be other things to be afraid of later. But lying there, drunk and hurting all over, I wasn't afraid. I wondered how it was for Wavy. She'd fallen in love, had her heart broken, almost had sex, and had her whole family taken away from her. Did she still have things to be afraid of? That Kellen wouldn't love her long enough. The years were adding up. Mom thought Wavy would get over it, but she was wrong. Wavy still loved him. But when he got out of prison, would he still love her? Wavy made her way as best she could, found ways to fit in on her terms. For instance, she didn't go to her senior prom, but she was the chairperson for the decoration committee. The prom was Valentine's themed, red and pink with hearts and hundreds of hand-tucked crepe paper roses with green sisal stems. Things like that always looked effortless in Wavy's hands. She strung elaborate garlands along the edges of the bleachers and in the corner where prom pictures would be taken. The garlands were pink and red with bits of gold foil alternating reversed hearts. Everyone assumed they were hearts, until halfway through the prom, when one of the parent chaperones admired the decorations at just the right angle. That year, none of the prom pictures could be used in the yearbook. Obscene, the school board called them. Instead of hearts, Wavy had very skillfully alternated between erect penises and curvaceous rumps that narrowed to delicate but well-defined vulvas. The school board threatened to keep her from graduating, but in the end, Wavy got to walk across the dais in her big boots. She accepted her diploma from the principal's grudgingly outstretched hand and walked to the other end of the stage. From up in the stands, home from my first year of college, I watched her kiss Kellen's ring. 4 years into a 10-year prison sentence. Did he feel the same? 13. Kellen. June 1987. The hearing room was small, the same gray cinder block as my cell. There was a table for the parole board, another for me and my lawyer, and some folding chairs along the wall for witnesses. I had to wear a leg iron, hooked to an eye bolt in the floor. But at least they didn't cuff me. The room was too warm. Close enough quarters, I wondered if Wavy would be able to smell me.
I'd showered like she might. Trimmed my hair. Shaved and tucked my shirt in. Not to impress the board. I didn't figure there was much I could do to make them like me. Heading into my fifth year, I was tired. I'd spent 4 years sitting around reading, lifting weights, and sleeping. 4 years thinking about Wavy, because I didn't have enough to do with my hands, especially in solitary. Odds on I was going to do another year before my next hearing, another year before I might get a chance to see Wavy again. After my lawyer, the parole board showed up. An old man, Kutchin, who I couldn't hardly believe had come all that way for me after the trouble I'd caused him. Then Brenda Newling walked in. Seeing her looking older, I wondered what Wavy looked like now. Brenda glared at me like she wanted to burn a hole in me, but it didn't. Wavy hadn't come, and if she wasn't there, I didn't care what happened. I knew the fight was going to come up, and that was the first thing the parole board mentioned. I see you had an altercation with a fellow inmate 6 months ago. A pretty serious one. The man ended up in the infirmary and you've been in administrative segregation since then? That doesn't exactly suggest you're ready for parole. Would you like to tell us about that? I didn't want to, but I had to say something. Look, because of my conviction, there's always some guy wanting to mess with me. He came at me with a shiv. Did you have some personal issue with him? The woman on the board said. I didn't know him. It's just because of what I pled to. Some guys, they find that out, they have it in for me. I had scars to show for 2 times I let my guard down. Inmates who have sexual convictions involving minors are often targeted by other inmates, my lawyer said. Mr. Barfoot has worked hard to rehabilitate himself.
Can you tell us what you've done to prepare yourself for parole?
I finished my GED. Also, Mr. Barfoot completed the court-mandated program for sex offenders, my lawyer said. I didn't like thinking about that. 3 months spending every day in the same room with child molesters and rapists. The whole thing gave me a creeping dread of myself, but I didn't have to lie in the exit interview. Do you still have sexual fantasies about young girls? They asked. No, I never had. I thought about Wavy 100 times a day, but Wavy was Wavy, not some young girl. Then it was Mr. Kutchin's turn to talk to the board. It choked me up so that I couldn't look at him. For reasons I still don't get, he took a chance on me when nobody else would. Jesse Joe's a good boy, he told the parole board. I was surprised they didn't laugh at him. I know he's been in some trouble with the law, but the fact is, he loved that girl. He treated her good, took care of her, made sure she went to school. He looked out for her when nobody else did. Not even her, sitting there glaring at me. He cut his eyes over at Brenda. She wasn't the one taking Wavy to school every day, I tell you what. I figured that all he meant to do was give me a decent character witness. But then he said, he'll have a job if he gets paroled. I'd hire him back tomorrow if I could. After he finished talking, he tried to come over and shake my hand. The guards had to explain to him he wasn't allowed to do that. Thanks, Mr. Kutchin. I really appreciate it, I said. He nodded and kind of waved at me. You take care. We'll be seeing you soon. I got this cussed wave runner. I can't hardly figure... Mr. Kutchin, the parole board head said. Sorry, I'm going. He went, and then it was just me and Brenda. She stood up and the parole board head said, You're Brenda Newling, the, victim's aunt?
Yes.
And you've got a statement?
She unfolded a piece of paper she'd clenched in her fist. I'm here today. Because Wavy found it too upsetting to come. I'm asking the board to turn down his request for parole, because the damage he's done isn't over. My niece turns 18 in July, and she still hasn't recovered. She was a vulnerable little girl, with no one to protect her from his predations. He presented himself as her friend and groomed her for a sexual relationship. He plied her with presents and seduced her. Betrayed her trust. She used to believe she was in love with him. She felt it was her fault that he assaulted her, that she'd led him on. She's almost 18 years old and she's never dated. She didn't go to her senior prom. She's never had any kind of normal, healthy relationship with someone her own age, and that's his fault. Although it happened on her 14th birthday, I'd like to point out to the board that she was born on July 19th at 8:30 in the evening. So in fact, when he raped her, technically she wasn't even 14. She was 13. And he stole her virginity on a desk in a dirty garage. He robbed her of her innocence, and she'll never be able to get that back.
Brenda was crying by the end. So was I. I didn't care what Brenda said, but I loved Wavy, and I'd lost her, and I wasn't even allowed to say that. When the parole board head asked, "Mr. Barfoot, would you like to answer Mrs. Newling?" I couldn't even say, "I lost the best thing that ever happened to me." Wasn't that punishment enough? I said, "I'm really sorry for what I did. I know that doesn't change it. But I really am sorry. I wish I could take it back." Some days I was sorry. Other days I was only sorry Liam got himself killed. Another few days and Wavy would have been my wife. Before my parole hearing, the two things were about equal, the same number of days feeling each way. But when the door never opened and Wavy never walked in, the scale tipped. If she wouldn't come see me on the one day she could have, I'd done a terrible thing.
Part 5. 1. Renee. September 1987. When I walked into my dorm room sophomore year, there was a kid standing on one of the desks, sticking glow-in-the-dark stars on the ceiling. Her hair was in a spiky pixie cut, and she wore 20-eyed Doc Martens. She looked about 12 or 13. "Are you Wavy?" I said, thinking, "Please no, please no." She nodded. "I'm Renee." She waved at me and put another star on the ceiling. Not in random patterns, but actual constellations. Had student housing really stuck me with a child prodigy roommate? I went to complain to the RA, who said, "What kid?" It turned out Wavy Quinn was 18. She wasn't a child. She was just really small. And quiet. Oh my God, was she quiet. I talk a lot, so I admit it was several days before I realized Wavy hadn't spoken to me. Not one word. I only noticed because by the end of the first week she still hadn't asked me about Jill Carmody. It's pathetic, but that was why I'd been looking forward to getting a new roommate. I was waiting for the moment she would ask about the memorial picture of Jill on my bulletin board. "So are you mad at me or something?" I said. "Did I do something to piss you off?" Wavy was sitting at her desk studying. 4 days into the semester and she was studying. She shook her head without even looking up. "I'm just missing my best friend. Next week is the anniversary of her death." For a second I thought even that had failed, but Wavy closed her book and looked over at my shrine to Jill. "I'm sorry," she said. I did my spiel. Jill was my best friend. Smart. Pretty. All-state volleyball champion. Killed by a drunk driver our senior year. I cried. I'm ashamed when I look back at how I played that game because I barely knew Jill. I once had a history class with her. When I went to college, I made up this story about my best friend dying because it made me more interesting. My freshman roommate and I stayed up all night hashing it out, me crying, her comforting me. All Wavy did was give me a sympathetic look and say, "That's sad." It made me feel like a poser. I mean, I was a poser, but I'd never felt like one before. After parents' weekend, I felt like even more of a fake. By then, I was used to what I thought of as Wavy's weirdness. I never saw her eat. And in 2 months, I'd heard her speak about 100 words, mostly things like yes, no, laundry, library, and shut up, I'm sleeping.
The Friday of Parents' Weekend, I came back to our room after class and the door was open. I heard someone mutter, "You son of a bitch." Wow. Another 5 words out of Wavy, one of them an expletive. Except it wasn't her. It was a middle-aged woman with short brown hair shoving something back into Wavy's desk drawer. "Hi, are you Mrs. Quinn?" I said. All the color drained out of her face as she closed the desk drawer.
"You must be Renee. I'm Brenda Newling. I'm Wavy's aunt."
"Oh, she's told me all about you." That's a joke. You know, because she doesn't talk much. Mrs. Newling didn't crack a smile.
"How is she? Really?"
"She's fine," I said. "I wish I could stick to a diet the way she does. Was there anything in particular you were looking for in her desk?"
"No, I just worry about her."
I put down my backpack, wondering what Wavy's aunt was looking for. Condoms? Drugs? Alcohol? Like we wouldn't have the sense to ditch that stuff before our parents visited. With my mom and dad coming on Saturday, there wasn't even aspirin in my desk drawer. I'd even tacked up the campus chapel schedule on my bulletin board. "Wavy studies a lot," I said.
"She always has. Is she making friends?"
"Friends?" It came out sounding bitchy. But was this woman for real? Mrs. Newling sat on the edge of Wavy's bed with a pleading look on her face. Oh, no. I was not doing the mother-roommate confidant routine, so I said, "She's friends with me. Does that count?" Before Mrs. Newling could answer, Wavy came back to the room with her cousin Amy in tow. After the three of them left, I got down to some overdue snooping of my own. In the back of Wavy's desk drawer was a brass picture frame. I may be self-centered, but I'm not oblivious. I'd asked about the photo Wavy kept on her bulletin board, her little brother, grinning with his 2 front teeth out. I would have asked about this picture, too, but I'd never seen it. The photo was of a big guy sitting on a motorcycle in front of an open garage door. He had pitch-black hair that was too long and his shirt was off, showing tattoos on his arms and chest. He was mostly muscle, but he was carrying some extra weight around the middle. That's my problem, too. It was a sunny day and he was laughing, having fun with the person behind the camera. Who was he? Right then, I realized I'd been going about things the wrong way. You make people interested in you by keeping secrets, not by passing them out like candy at Halloween. When Wavy came back from giving her aunt a tour of campus, she sat down to study. On a Friday night. There was no other way, so I said, "When I got home, your aunt was snooping in your desk. Is there anything in there you wouldn't want her to find?" Nailed it in one. Wavy jerked open the drawer and grabbed the picture. With a crazy, pissed-off look on her face, she polished the glass with the hem of her skirt. I stepped closer, pretending I was seeing it for the first time. "That's a cool motorcycle. Who is that?" Considering how eager I was to blurt out my fake tragedy, I couldn't believe Wavy didn't want to tell me. But she looked me over, evaluating whether I could be trusted. "I just wondered, because your aunt seemed pretty upset about finding it. So who is he?"
"Kellen, my fiancé."
She held her hand out so I could look at the ring on her finger. I'd noticed it before, but not thought anything about it. "You're engaged?" She nodded. "Why haven't I met him? Where is he?"
"Prison."
"Are you serious? Why? What did he do?" I said.
"I need to study."
Wavy put the picture away and sat down at her desk, done talking. Poof. I was invisible. She couldn't hear me. "So are your parents coming to visit this weekend?" Apparently she could hear me ask that because she shook her head. "Why not?"
"They're dead."
"Oh my God, that's so sad. What happened?" That was what people always said when I told them about Jill Carmody.
"They were murdered," Wavy said. As soon as the words left her mouth, I knew I had to take down my fake-ass shrine to Jill.
You can't milk a pretend tragedy when your roommate has a real one. It's too pathetic. I'd told Mrs. Newling that Wavy and I were friends, but it wasn't true. We were just roommates. Even after I knew her parents had been murdered and her fiancé was in prison for statutory rape, I saw it as some titillating soap opera. Wavy and I didn't become friends until our second year together in the dormitory. That was the year I did something so stupid I was too embarrassed to tell anyone. With me, that's saying something. If it'll make people pay attention to me, I'm perfectly willing to humiliate myself. I slept with my German professor, and not just once, but almost the whole fall semester. It wasn't like I did it for the grade, because I was good at German, but I was so flattered that he was attracted to me in all my chatty, airheaded, you know, fatness. His wife eventually caught us, and there was a huge scene, with the German professor saying, "It was a stupid fling. It meant nothing." That was me. The stupid fling that meant nothing. The asshole wouldn't even give me a ride home. I cried the whole way, walking across campus from his house to the dorm. I was an exhausted, hungry wreck. I sat at my desk, sobbing and rummaging in the drawers for anything to eat to make me feel better. Wavy got out of bed in her nightgown, took her student ID card off her desk, and motioned for me to follow her. She could be so bossy. Downstairs, the corridor to the cafeteria was closed at night by a big steel door, which Wavy unlocked in 10 seconds of fiddling around with her ID card. She unlocked the door to the kitchen the same way. Inside it was dark except for the emergency exit signs glowing red like hell, until Wavy opened the giant cooler. In the halo of its blue, misty light, she laid out food for me. Quart boxes of strawberries, a vat of chocolate pudding, an entire tray filled with little squares of lemon cake, a 5-gallon bucket of Rocky Road ice cream, and a can of whipped cream. That's my idea of a friend. 2. Wavy. November 1988. Renee liked to take quizzes out of women's magazines. They were silly, but good for the same thing knitting was good for. The quizzes helped Renee empty her heart, and she filled it so quickly with the wrong things it was no wonder she needed to empty it. Lying on our beds on Sunday nights, Renee read the quizzes out loud and I wrote down our answers. "What's your romance style?" Renee was the bubbly butterfly, flirty but fickle, quick to seal the deal and move on. My score didn't fit any of the categories, so Renee invented a new one, wallflower nymphomaniac. "I don't even understand how you could get engaged without having some kind of conversation. Did he just say, 'Do you want to marry me?' and you nodded?" I nodded, and Renee laughed. I looked up at Kellen's picture, which traveled back and forth between my nightstand and my desk drawer, depending on my mood. When my heart hurt too much, I hid it in the drawer. I got out of bed and picked up the picture, intending to put it away. Renee stopped laughing and took the picture out of my hand.
"That is one seriously beefy hunk of man," she said, to tease me.
I snorted and let her put the picture back on my nightstand. Another night before I put it away. What I missed most about Kellen wasn't riding behind him on the panhead. I missed watching him eat. Renee ate in darting little bites and without chewing enough, the same way she filled her heart. Too quickly, and with too much talking and not enough feeling. Our second year as roommates, I went home with Renee at Thanksgiving and found out why she ate that way. The Dales lived in a neighborhood full of mansions with wrought iron gates and front lawns like public parks. They were rich, but they ate so desperately they might as well have been stealing food from a stranger's garbage. Even I didn't eat like that anymore. Mrs. Dale heaped everyone's plate up with turkey, potatoes, stuffing, and gravy. After that, pie and whipped cream. I admired the generosity of all that food. I managed to eat a few bites of turkey and some pieces of buttered dinner roll for the Dales, small, precise things that I could put in my mouth with people watching. The mashed potatoes were yellow with butter, but they were too complicated. They reminded me of rules I was trying to forget.
"You're not hungry, little girl?" Renee's grandfather said.
"It's okay, Dad."
Mrs. Dale gave me a big fake smile. Renee had warned her about me.
"So are you still dating the boy you told us about, Richard?"
Mr. Dale said.
"No, not anymore," Renee muttered.
There was no boy. Richard was the German professor who made Renee's heart burn so hot.
"Why didn't you tell me you broke up with him, sweetie?"
Mrs. Dale put another slice of pie on Renee's plate and suffocated it in whipped cream. Renee glared at the pie and pushed a nervous bite of it into her mouth, frowning as she chewed.
Well, what happened? Mrs. Dale said.
You know, Wavy's engaged, Renee said.
Really? What does your fiancé do? Is he a student, too?
Mr. Dale raised an eyebrow at his wife.
He's in prison, Renee said.
Mr. Dale almost choked on a bite of pie. In the quiet that came after, I prepared myself to nod, to make the answer I always made.
Whatever you want to be true, it is.
Renee barked a nervous laugh and said, God, I'm kidding! I'm kidding! Wavy doesn't have a fiancé in prison.
Oh, Renee, you and your jokes, Mrs. Dale said.
Everyone laughed.
So, are you still going to the gym? How's your diet going?
The fork fell out of Renee's hand and clattered onto the plate next to the half-eaten pie. Renee looked like she was going to gag, but she swallowed. I felt so angry I had to dig my nails into my hands. All that delicious food spoiled in Renee's stomach. Mrs. Dale was as dangerous as Val. She might as well have put her fingers in Renee's mouth and pulled the pie out. She might as well have shouted, Don't eat that! That's dirty! For Kellen's Christmas letter, I devoted a paragraph to mashed potatoes and another to the reliable deliciousness of cold pizza. Renee and I always split a pizza on Sunday nights when the cafeteria was closed. She ate her half when it got there, hot enough to burn the roof of her mouth. I ate mine after it was cold, while Renee was asleep. I wrote to Kellen about how I wanted to cook for him and watch him eat. He approached food the same way he approached kissing, slowly, thoroughly, and with concentration. Watching him chew and swallow was lovely. Solid muscles working, sending food to fuel all of him. Since all my letters came back unread, I mostly wrote them for myself, for the pleasure of writing. Dear Kellen, tonight was the first night I could see Orion, and I wished you were here, wearing his belt. If we could travel to Alpha Centauri and look at our stars, the sun would be part of Cassiopeia. From Earth, they seem so far apart, but from Alpha Centauri, our sun is the sixth star, as close as the others. Kellen and I were like that. At night I thought of him in his cell, 237 miles away according to my car's odometer. Viewed from my bed, he was a distant constellation. From Alpha Centauri, we were twin stars, side by side. 3. Renee. April 1989. Wavy wrote more letters than anyone I knew. Every week she wrote to her cousins and her aunt, twice a month to her high school Spanish teacher, in Spanish. She also wrote letters to the lawyer who oversaw her trust fund. Her typewriter was electric, but she pounded on it like a manual when she wrote to her lawyer, because she and her aunt were at war over Kellen's money. Brenda used the trust to control Wavy, and that included forcing her to live in the dorm. If we wanted to get an apartment together, Wavy had to convince the trust's lawyer to overrule her aunt. That required letters. Typing until I thought my ears would bleed from the sound of it. The winning letter mentioned Mrs. Brenda Newling's callous indifference to my personal comfort. That was how Wavy referred to her aunt in letters to the lawyer, like she was a cruel stranger. It also made reference to her special dietary needs and the difficulty of satisfying them in a communal living environment. Another way of saying she had an eating disorder. Mostly, she ate in secret and stockpiled food, but when she was really stressed out, like during finals, she ate out of the trash, like a raccoon. Special dietary needs, other people's discarded pizza. Wavy also wrote letters to anybody she thought could help locate her brother. She had a huge file box of correspondence from former neighbors, her uncle's old parole officer, teachers at the last school Donald attended. Years of work, starting from the moment she lost him. Then there were letters to Kellen. She spent days writing them in beautiful penmanship on expensive paper. They all came back opened, taped back closed, and stamped unauthorized correspondence. Those letters seemed so wonderfully tragic to me. Each one a message she would never get. A note in a bottle, bobbing on the ocean. Lost. 4. Kellen. June 1989. My second parole hearing was almost exactly like the first, except old man Kutchin was laid up in the hospital with a heart attack. The room was too warm, and Brenda Newling showed up to read a statement about how I destroyed Wavy's life. I'd nearly convinced myself Brenda kept Wavy away from the last hearing, but now she was 18. If she wanted to see me, she could have come. She didn't. When the letter came saying I'd been granted parole, I couldn't hardly believe it. But 2 weeks later, I was free. Or as free as I could be in a halfway house with other ex-cons, checking in with my parole officer every week. I wasn't allowed to live near a school or a daycare, so when I moved out of the halfway house, it was hard to find a place to live. And I had to file my address with the sex offender registry. Getting a job wasn't easy either. Old man Kutchin ended up closing the shop, and it wasn't likely anybody else in Powell was going to hire me. So I got paroled to Wilburg, which was bigger than Geringer, almost 100,000 people. The Quick Lube place was in a strip mall on the other end of town from my apartment, but it had one thing going for it. The manager didn't give me a hard time about my conviction. Gary was my age, maybe a little older, and bald. He looked at my application and said, "The felony. I have to ask." I dated this girl who was 14. Her aunt caught us fooling around. I pled guilty so the girl wouldn't have to testify. I'm not proud of it, but I'm not a child molester. It was this one stupid thing I did. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. I won't steal stuff. I'll show up on time. I'm good with about anything mechanical. I kept talking, waiting for the hammer to fall, but Gary rubbed his head and said, "Geez, a felony charge seems like a raw deal if the girl was willing." I didn't rape her. I just messed up. I got the job. It was more like a factory than a garage, just changing the oil in one car after another. Mindless work, which was good. 4 months after my parole, I was living in this damp basement apartment in an old boarding house. The sex offender registry, it was only supposed to protect other people from me. While I was living in that apartment, I had the tires on my truck slashed and somebody spray-painted pedophile on my door. Pedophile was spelled wrong. I moved to a different building, farther away from the nearest school, but spitting distance from the train yard. For a few weeks, there was no trouble, but then somebody put up flyers to let people know a sex offender was living in the building. A couple nights later, these two young guys stopped me coming up the alley. "If you showed up dead, I bet the cops wouldn't even care," said the one who hung back behind his friend. He wore a gold cross on a chain. "They might even give us a medal if we took care of you, you fucking scumbag." The braver one jabbed me in the chest with his finger. No big deal. But eventually somebody was going to try something serious. That's what was getting ready to happen the night I met Beth. I closed the shop some nights, which was more money, but it meant I didn't get home until after dark. Being out wasn't all that different from being in prison. I had to be on my guard all the time, especially since somebody put up those flyers about me. So I wasn't surprised when those same two douchebags came at me in the alley. "I don't think you got the message last time," said the one with the cross necklace. "We don't want your kind around here," the brave one said. They must have figured two against one gave them an advantage. They didn't know I could take two guys easy when I was sober. Drunk, I could take 10. When they rushed me, I didn't demolish them like when I used to get in bar fights. I could have put them in the hospital, but I didn't want to end up back in jail. So I took a lot more punches than I gave. "Hey, back off, you assholes! I already called the cops!" somebody yelled behind me. That was enough to send the two douchebags running. As I was leaning up against the side of a trash dumpster, trying to catch my breath, this woman walked up to me. She kept one hand in her purse, I'm guessing on a can of mace. "Are you okay?" she said. "Yeah, thanks." Did you really call the cops? No, not really. I figured she'd go back the way she'd come, but she stayed there. You sure you're all right? She said. Yeah, thanks. Have a good night. After that, I decided breaking parole was better than getting worked over. So the next day, I bought me a baseball bat. A couple weeks later, going out to my truck, I passed the woman who saved my ass. I was gonna pretend I didn't recognize her, but she stopped me. Hey, Babe Ruth, you have any more trouble with those guys? She said. Not yet. Looks like you're ready for them, though. I'm Beth. She held out her hand to shake. I guess she didn't see the flyers. Jesse Joe. You're a mechanic? She looked at my uniform shirt with my name embroidered on one side and the name of the shop on the other. Would you mind giving me a hand with my car? I did it, even though it made me 20 minutes late to work. After all, I owed her one. That was my answer when she offered to cook me dinner as payment for fixing her car. We were even. No, come over at about 7 and I'll feed you. A month after that first dinner, I moved in with Beth. It made money sense for us to share her apartment. The night I moved in was the first time we had sex. We both got about half drunk. She told me what to do, and I did it. A lot less awkward than me trying to figure out what to do. I guess it made both of us feel less lonely for a while. Beth was older than me, maybe 50. Old enough she had a couple grandkids and dyed her hair red to cover up gray. Like my ma, she had a big scar on her belly from a C-section. The one time I touched it, she slapped me. I knew I'd waited too long to tell Beth about my conviction, because when I finally did, she gave me a dirty look and said, "What is wrong with men? What's the appeal of a 14-year-old? Are they just easier to control? Is that it? They don't talk back?" That was hard to take from a woman who bossed me around the same way she did her kids. Same woman who in the middle of sex once said to me, "Damn, Jesse, don't you wear deodorant? You fucking stink. Get off me." I loved her. I wanted to marry her. I said, "Huh, but instead you just had sex with her." "Do you want me to leave?" I wanted to leave. Sitting on the sofa with her curling her lip up at me was as bad as a parole hearing. "I don't know. Let me think about it," Beth said. I slept on the couch that night, and the next morning she said, "It was only the one time? You don't have a thing for little girls?" It was the one stupid mistake. She's the only girl I ever dated who was under 18. Wavy was the only girl I'd ever really dated. "Okay," Beth said. I told her what I had to do. The plea deal, the sentence, the no-contact order, the sex offender registry. Whenever Beth's grandkids visited, I stayed at a motel. Other than that, she never brought it up. But I always felt like she was looking at me and thinking, "What is wrong with men?" Being with Beth was mostly better than being alone, as long as I got drunk before we had sex. As long as she didn't say, "You need to lose some weight or you're going to have a heart attack," while I was trying to enjoy my dinner. Other times, being alone would have been better. Especially at night, when I was lying awake next to Beth. She never put her head on my shoulder, and definitely never pressed her face into my neck or my armpit and sniffed me. She didn't know the names of any constellations. Wavy had said, "Stay," and I stayed. She'd said, "Hold on tight," and I held on tight. I knew I ought to let go of her. I couldn't.
5. Renee. May 1990. In the fall of 1989, Wavy and I got our apartment, this funky place with 2 bedrooms, a giant bathroom, and a tiny living room. It was part of a big old house, so there were lots of funny things about it, like the pair of faucets that poked out of the living room ceiling right over the couch. We never figured out what they were for. I spent most of the first year in our apartment trying to convince Wavy that we should throw a party. Wasn't that the point of having our own apartment? Being able to do whatever we wanted?
Obviously, Wavy wasn't a big fan of parties, but she finally agreed that we should invite some people over to celebrate the end of the spring semester.